Welcome to Uncharted, an Arctic 360 podcast about the impact of COVID-19 on the North American Arctic. All summer long, we're talking to the people who live, work, and govern the Arctic to understand how we move forward from this moment in history. Today's theme is Northern gold mining. As a buffer against uncertainty, gold has been increasing in value even before the pandemic. Luckily for Canadians, there's a lot of gold deposits in the north, but what exactly do these grand economic trends mean for communities and miners on the ground? You could say that none of it remains a gold standard in COVID control. And so I wanted to talk to somebody who is in charge of helping one of the biggest companies in the province adapt to the pandemic and the economic uncertainty that came with it. Enter Amar Al-Jundi, who is the president of Agnico Eagle since 2015, having previously served as the senior vice president and chief financial officer. Before working at Agnico, he has over 20 years of experience in business and finance strategy and extensive experience in mining, capital markets, and banking. Today, we talk about the logistics of mining in Nunavut compared to other parts of Canada and how that's impacted by infrastructure, as well as the ways in which COVID has impacted operations and community consultations. And of course, we talk about the future of gold mining and the lost opportunity that comes when we don't invest in our north. I'm Erica Wallace, and when it comes to COVID-19, this is Uncharted. Well, thanks so much for taking the time today.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start off with a question. You know, just real simple, can you walk me through some of your mining concessions in Nunavut? Where are they located? And then I wanted to know, what is Agnico's relationship between mines and then nearby communities?
Well, our mines are located in the Kivalliq region of Nunavut. We think Nunavut is a fantastic place to operate. It has fantastic resource potential, but it really has fantastic potential in the people as well. They are, in our experience, hardworking, entrepreneurial, innovative, smart, industrious, and we think that lots of people understand the resource potential, but what we really like is the potential of the partners we have up there and the people up there. A little bit of background on Nunavut that's helpful.
Okay.
While Nunavut was being negotiated in the 90s, the leadership had the vision to implement a lot of very good things. And they ended up owning directly 18% of the land.
Wow.
When you think about that, population at the time was probably 30,000 people, and 18% of Nunavut is about equivalent to 60% of France. So it's a large area, and what they did, again, very smart, was they hired very good geologists who had the instructions to identify the land. Part of that 18% was land that had great mineral potential, because even then they realized that as part of the development of Nunavut, mm-hmm. obviously not all, but as part of it, they had to look at practically the resource potential, and they wanted to be the owners of that. So for us as operators in Nunavut, it's fantastic to be dealing with the local Inuit, because a lot of the land we operate is land that they own and particularly chose because of its mineral resource potential. So really, you know, we're on the same wavelength with them, which is, you know, from their perspective, open to resource development, but it has to be done responsibly.
Right.
It has to create benefits for them, and they can find good partner to do that. And I think Agnico Eagle over the last, 15 years has demonstrated that we're probably the best partner for that.
Hmm. And that land ownership, does that make it different to have a gold mine in Nunavut versus like Northwest Territories or the Yukon? Does it make it like preferable to put it in Nunavut? How does that work?
Well, the resource potential always drives that.
Okay.
First, there has to be the mineral in the ground, and that's the number one item.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the number two item is who are your partners, and certainly we've found the Inuit in Nunavut to be great partners. Now, that said, everything, we don't operate directly in the Northwest Territories, but everything I've heard about operating there is that it's very good to operate there as well. And Canada in general is a great place, probably the best place in the world to operate as a miner. Hmm. But you know, going back to Nunavut, we've been there for probably a couple of decades, but we've had a direct investment, started direct investments in 2007. And since 2007, we've invested over $7 billion. So this is one company, $7 billion Canadian in Nunavut since there. And in the last 2.5 years alone, we've invested about $1.5 billion building two big mines. So right now we're the largest miner in Nunavut. We're the largest private sector employer. And remarkably, the two mines that I just talked about, those two mines will represent about 25% of the entire GDP of Nunavut, which is really quite remarkable. Wow. If you think about it. We directly and indirectly employ over 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. Again, this is in the Kivalliq region of Nunavut. And so that, you know, that represents a high percentage of the working population. We have about a third of our employees are local Nunavumiut, which we're quite proud of. Our peers on average have between 10 and 15%, so we have more than double the average. And importantly, these are local people who are trained and can work not just with Agnico, but hopefully this is training that will serve them well for the rest of their career. We spend about $100 million a year on payroll. Again, about a third of that to our roughly one third Inuit employees. And we also, and this is important, we've also helped the local business community become established. Last year, we spent about $500 million in local goods and services, which is a huge benefit to the sort of commercial growth of Nunavut. I think actually Nunavut had the highest economic growth of anywhere in Canada over the last couple of years.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah. So, you know, we've really, you know, our philosophy is we won't go to any region for just one mine. And we believe we could be in Nunavut, honestly, for 100 years. And so if you're coming into a region and you want to be there, not just for the first mine, but for the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, you have to be environmentally responsible. You have to take care of the land and understand that you are a guest in other people's land and take that seriously. And you have to, more than anything else, make sure the local people want you there. And the only way they're going to want you there is if the local people benefit.
So are the communities that you work with involved in any equity partnerships with the mining operations?
Well, certainly we have helped a lot of the local businesses get going. And there's different ways you can do that. But part of that is by guaranteeing them and entering into significant initial contracts. So as I mentioned, last year alone, we spent about $500 million on local industry and local suppliers. But furthermore, our partners up there include the Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated and the Kivalliq Inuit Association. So these are two Nunavumiut, effectively a government, local government representatives. And between these two entities, we've signed three Inuit impact and benefit agreements. Now these agreements, they cover things, the standard things, including training, employment, opportunities for local businesses. But to put some numbers on this, they also include direct payments to these two entities. And since 2007, to these two entities alone, the Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated and the Kivalliq Inuit Association, since 2007, we've already paid directly over $109 million in royalties and fees. And over the life of these two mines, the current life, which is about 15 years, These two mines are expected to pay directly to these two entities about $650 million.
Wow.
So it's a big, big number. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that number goes up as we continue to find more gold over time because it's paid as a percentage of the gold that's produced. Mm-hmm. So we really have a lot of direct relationship with a lot of the commercial interests there. And we've been able to be very constructive, and we're proud to be supportive of local industry and the local communities.
You were talking about obviously investing money into these mines, and we talk a lot about sort of this really lack of critical infrastructure in Nunavut specifically. How does that change mining operations, you know, from the rest of Canada or from your operations around the world? Because I think you have a mine in Finland, is that right?
We have mine in Finland, in mines in Mexico, mines in Quebec and on Ontario. We have some projects. So we operate all over the world. And what I would say is that, again, Nunavut is a fantastic place to operate with huge potential. Mm-hmm. And it's a welcoming place to do business. But Nunavut is also a very expensive place to do business due to its remoteness, its limited transportation, telecommunications, energy infrastructures. Frankly, they're almost non-existent. According to the Mining Association of Canada, Canada's Arctic is the most expensive jurisdiction for mineral development anywhere in the world.
Wow.
They estimate that building and operating a mine there, mm-hmm, including Nunavut, is about 2.5 times more expensive than it would be, say, in Quebec, mm-hmm, or Ontario or in other countries. And 70% of that cost difference is attributable to this lack of infrastructure that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So when we build our mines, these two mines that are now 25% of the GDP and the largest private employer, we've had to not just build the mines, but we've had to build all of the infrastructure to support those mines, including a lot of infrastructure that typically the average business in the South would take for granted. We've had to build, for example, our own electricity infrastructure.
Right.
We've had to build our own port facilities. We've had to build our own fuel delivery and storage infrastructure. You can't, in Nunavut, you can't just go and buy diesel locally. You have to barge it in, you have to set up storage tanks, you have to deal with all of the issues around it, even something as simple as a telecommunications network or roads. We've outside the communities, outside of the 25 communities in Nunavut, there are a total of about 200 kilometers of roads, and we've built them all.
Wow. And so that infrastructure stays in place when you leave, I guess, then?
It does. I mean, some of it is mine specific, but a lot of it is helpful. For example, these roads, the communities use the roads. And what we've said is when the mines reach the end of their life, our intention is if the communities want it, it's up to them, we would leave the power generating stations up there for them, because we've got, frankly, state-of-the-art, extremely high efficient engines that will run not just on diesel but also natural gas if it gets there. What they're using right now are, in some cases, 50-year-old crappy diesel generators that the government of Canada hasn't replaced yet. So some of the infrastructure can stay, but to be fair, some of it is mine specific.
Right. Is that something that you'd want to see the government sort of approach in the future, sort of being able to foot the bill for some of those basic infrastructure costs?
Well, I think the government has a real opportunity to help develop the potential of the North. And again, it's yeah, not just the mineral resources, it's the people up there. Right now, they don't have the Inuit population doesn't have the same opportunity in many cases as other Canadians do, which is a shame and a tragedy. And if you think about it, you know, the federal government made a decision in the late 1800s, I think it was 1880s, to build a railway into British Columbia.
Right.
And it really opened up the West. And it cost money at the time, but the return has been tremendous. If you look at, again, as an example, with just two mines, we're 25% of the GDP, and we're contributing $650 million estimated to these two government entities. Now, these are the local government entities. So the potential is there, but private industry can play a big role, and we are playing a big role, and we're happy to do it, but we can't do it all ourselves. The local population, they don't even have decent internet access.
Right.
They don't have decent health care. And when you're talking about investing, it's not just in physical infrastructure, but probably more important, it's in the people. And what I mean by that is you have to invest in education, in training, in housing, in healthcare, in fundamental things that we take for granted that allow you and me to go to work every day and to have opportunities. They don't have that. And that's a shame, and the federal government has a real opportunity to make an investment. It's not a charity, it's an investment, and I promise you that investment will pay back multiple times, but more importantly, it's the right thing to do for the people who live there.
Right. You mentioned healthcare and health and safety. How has COVID impacted the mining operations, and what have you learned from these past few months that you're going to carry into, the pandemic going forward?
Well, in Nunavut and in all of our operations, so as a mining company, you have to be prepared to isolate and separate people who are ill. And this goes back to just the flu. So, for example, if you operate a mine in a remote area, whether it's in Mexico or Finland or in Nunavut, you can't have somebody show up with a flu and then get everybody sick.
Sure.
So mining companies benefit from protocols and safety systems already in place designed to separate people. But COVID was quite exceptional. And it's worth talking a little bit about our experience in Nunavut. So first let me start by saying the Nunavut has not had a single case of COVID, not one. And the community and the local governments are rightfully proud of that. And we, as the largest employer and the largest private industry, are very proud of that. We moved very quickly to implement additional extraordinary measures to protect the health and safety of not just our employees, but also of the communities in which we operate. And really, it was a remarkable accomplishment. What we were worried about was that in Nunavut, in particular, where a lot of people live in the same house, because you don't have, getting back to this infrastructure, you don't have decent housing infrastructure.
Okay.
You have a lot of elderly people living with their families, sort of a multi-generational culture, which is a fantastic thing. It's a great thing. But it leaves these older people potentially at risk, particularly when you don't have decent healthcare infrastructure in place. So we were determined as a company to work very closely with the local governments and the local health authorities, including Nunavut's chief medical officer, to make sure that we not just minimized, but eliminated the risk of us bringing COVID into Nunavut. And the only practical way you can do that, and we did this very quickly, within frankly a day or two, we sent all of our Inuit-based workforce home.
Right.
And we had to do that because we have people coming from the south on a daily basis, and we had to make the chance of transmission go to zero.
Right.
So our minds, there is zero human interaction between our southern employees and our Inuit-based workforce. They've all been sent home. They're still at home. We'd like to bring them back as soon as possible. We're working with the local government and the local health people, again, including the chief medical officer, to figure out how we can bring them back safely. But until we can do that, they're still at home, and we're still paying 75% of their salary.
Oh, great.
Now, the other thing that we were able to do, one of the things we were able to do very quickly, was to get testing. And I'm talking DNA level, high quality testing. Early in April, we were able to deal with a very well-known virologist who is based in Quebec, works at one of the universities in research, did a lot of work with the Ebola vaccine, and he and his team were quite interested in being able to help and mitigate the risks in Nunavut. So starting in early April, we were able to test all of our employees to ensure none of them had COVID. And in fact, we're at a point now where we've got another lab in Val-d'Or. So as I mentioned, we fly people up daily. We are now in a position where before you get on the flight, you get tested. By the time the flight lands, we have the results.
Wow.
And so we can control it 100%.
Right.
And anybody who and we haven't had any, but anybody who would be positive, they're sent back immediately the same day on the same plane, and anybody sitting around them is sent back. And by the way, when they get there, they're still we have all the safety and isolation protocols in place already. So we've really, I think our team, with the coordination through the Nunavut government and health authorities, who have been exceptional, we are jointly very proud that there's not been a single case, and we're very happy about the 100% physical isolation, so that they're not at risk.
I was going to ask you about sort of communication infrastructure as well. I was reading a CBC article about some wastewater that needed to be released from an Agnico mine into a lake, and then some tension in the community just from a lack of community consultation. And so I was wondering, you know, how has COVID impacted your ability to do these consultations, especially given, you know, the lack of internet? Can you even still do them right now?
Well, it's made it more difficult, but that's not an excuse. And I want to be very clear that we have always been and continue to be committed to an open relationship with full communication. And as I said, if we expect to be guests in their land for generations, we have to do that,
right.
And we will do that. The water you're referring to, it's just a containment pond where we collect rainwater and snowmelt that falls around the mine site. It's not saline water, and it's not water that's gone through the process plant. It's just rain and snow that we collect because we don't want it getting into the mine. We collect it, and then we release it slowly over time just to manage the amount of water flow. What happened was when you get exceptionally high rain and snow melt, which we had last year, not this year, last year, those containment ponds were full, and we were worried they would overflow in the spring. And to go through the process of doing it, we didn't have the time. So the recommendation, and this was actually proposed by the Nunavut Water Board, was to what they call an emergency amendment to discharge more water. Again, this is clean water. It's not saline. It's not processed. It's just collected from rain and snow. And that's what we did, and it was just because we thought these things would overflow with the snow melt, and then you couldn't control it. So in retrospect, I think we probably could have done a better job in communicating that. Yes, COVID has made it more difficult, because it used to be we go to the communities and we talk to people, and the elders who they respect show up, and we really couldn't do that now. And as you mentioned, the internet infrastructure, it's not like you can just get on Teams, everybody goes on and you have a conference, although we're trying to improve that. So we had a challenge with that. We acknowledge it wasn't perfect. We acknowledge and readily accept that there absolutely has to be full communication that COVID is not an excuse to do less. And we're working, frankly, to try to improve that. But it is a challenge because the broadband and internet capacity up there is, frankly, terrible. Mm-hmm. But we're working on it. And it could be something like maybe what we'll do is maybe we can have a radio call-in show.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like we talked about, or maybe we can do something better on Facebook. Mm-hmm. We're working with them to try to figure that out.
Right. Yeah, it's been good to see all the creative solutions coming out of COVID, for sure.
We're trying.
I just wanted to sort of zoom out a little bit and just talk about more the economic uncertainty caused by COVID. And I understand that gold is performing extremely well right now. And I just wondered if you could explain a little bit about that, why we're seeing that, and then how it's impacted Agnico.
Sure. Well, I'll start first with your question on why is gold performing the way it is. Simply put, gold has become the best, probably the best financial asset in the world. It is now a legitimate currency, and what's happening, and we started seeing this several years ago, several years ago our investors were largely resource-based people who had a view specifically on gold and resource and mining and that type of thing. What we've seen the last few years is a lot of generalist investors have become very interested in gold, and these are smart people. These are people who can invest in anything. They can invest in Microsoft, they can invest in Tesla, they can invest in anything they want. A lot of them have started to look at gold. And the reason they're looking at gold is what they're seeing are governments all over the world spending money and printing money hand over fist.
Right.
And so what happens is, and I'll give you an example, let's say in 2008 when we had the significant financial crisis,
mm-hmm.
I'll use the U.S. government only because I'm familiar with it, not because it's particularly good or bad. It's about average. But
sure.
What happened were governments went in and they correctly to deal with severe economic downturn, they pumped a lot of money into the system in unorthodox ways, including going out and buying bonds. The idea was always that they would turn around and sell those, and this was an unusual thing that they did to deal with the volatility and something that made sense. But what's happened is they realized that this is a tool that they can continue to use, and they've not only not reversed that unusual thing, they've doubled down over and over again. And so, for example, in 2008, in the U.S., the total government debt was about $10 trillion. Last year, it got to $23 trillion. And so before we get to COVID, what people are seeing is they're seeing governments doing everything they can to put money into the system to support asset prices, which is usually means very low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
People's house prices are up, which gets them voters. It gets the stock market up, which gets them voters. But really, they're just printing money and putting it into the system. And there's now a term they call the Fed put, which means the Fed's going to come in and just put money in anytime. So that, if gold is a financial asset and a currency, which it is, even the generalist investors who can invest in anything say, you know, I should probably own some of that as protection against all this money printing. Mm-hmm. And what's happened with COVID is just the U.S. alone has put another roughly $7 trillion
right.
in a few months mm-hmm. into the market. And so people are saying, look, they're really accelerating this money printing, and therefore this currency of gold, which is the best currency, should go up in value. And that's what's happening. And so for us, absolutely, Agnico is going to benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just built, we are one of the few large gold companies that's actually growing production on a per share basis. We're going to be this year close to, as we get through COVID and everything, into the second half of this year and next year, we're going to be close to, if not at, record gold production per share. Wow. And now we're selling it at record gold prices. And so we are going to be generating exceptional returns. And the governments and the people of Nunavut are going to benefit in that in a few ways. One is, as the price of gold goes up, the payments we make go up, because the payments we make are based on a percent of the gold that we produce multiplied by the current gold price.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that this trend had predated COVID. I was sort of under the assumption that it had sort of been caused by COVID.
No, and that's an important point. Yes, there is a knee-jerk reaction that when things are difficult, people buy gold.
Right.
Absolutely, and that had probably the first initial reaction. But really what you're seeing is an acceleration of a trend that has been going on now for a number of years. You know, I've used 2008 as a good point to kind of put things into perspective. Right. But this has been going on for a number of years. And the other thing I would say is, when there's a vaccine, and I'm knocking on wood right now, and when this COVID is all behind us, the $7 trillion the U.S. spent by pumping into the market, that's gone.
Right.
That's not coming back. Right. And so, you know, I think anybody who thinks that, well, as soon as there's a vaccine, well, then the markets are going to be great and gold's going to come down. It's not. The reason gold is up isn't because of the uncertainty so much. It's because of this printing press. And that printing press is printing as fast as it ever has.
Right. Do you see gold playing a role in Canada's economic recovery?
Well, I think so, sure. I mean, you know, we are making more money than we've ever made before, and so we're paying more taxes than we've ever paid before, and we're employing people, and we're going to be growing our business. We're making higher direct payments to governments. I tell you, you know, I don't want to speak for a government, but if I'm the you know, say the government of Nunavut, and I'm dealing with all of these additional costs and difficulties associated with COVID, I'm kind of happy to be getting this additional money from gold royalties. And if I'm the Canadian government and I'm supporting people, which I should do, I'm happy that the gold miners are now going to be paying a lot more taxes, because that's going to help me, you know, manage my budget.
Right. Sure. Well, I guess I'll wrap up sort of by just asking you one more question. And that's, sure. You know, about your CEO, Sean Boyd. It's been talking about the role that Canada's North will play in our country's future as well, and sort of the need for like a real infrastructure strategy to make that happen. So I guess simply put, like, how much opportunity do we lose every year by not investing in the North?
Well, you know, as we started this discussion, there is great potential in the North. Mm-hmm. There is great potential in, I'll repeat myself, in the physical resources, but more importantly, in the human resources. And Canada is a proud country with a proud history, and there's nothing wrong to say that a big part of that history of our economic development was originally based on resource development. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned during the discussion earlier, the Nunavummiut themselves have identified, by the land they chose to have, that responsible resource development is going to be a part of their economic development. So what I would say is that if you take a look at just one company, to your question of how much opportunity are we giving up, mm-hmm. Agnico Eagle alone is, you know, last year spent $500 million on businesses and suppliers in Nunavut that wasn't there before. That none of that industry would have been there before. And we're one company with two mines is 25% of the GDP. Mm-hmm. It's largely responsible for Nunavut being the fastest growing economy in Canada over the last few years. If one company in two mines is going to be paying to the NTI and the KIA $650 million just from these two mines, right, you can see that the potential economic return is excellent, but we can't we can play an important role. By we, I don't mean Agnico, I mean private industry. We can play an important role, but we can't do everything ourselves. Education, I'd probably start with that. You know, there's not a university anywhere in Nunavut. Mm-hmm. If I'm a young person and I want to be the general manager of the Agnico Eagle Mine and I want to become an engineer or an accountant or a geologist to give me that opportunity, I shouldn't have to go to Ottawa or to Toronto or to Winnipeg. You know, I should be able to go to a school locally. If I want to, housing is a big issue up there. You can't practically expect private industry to build a housing infrastructure or the fiber optic network or the health system. You know, these are things that the government has to do. And I promise you, if the government does its share, the returns will be fantastic. And to be fair, we've had a lot of support. The Honorable Carolyn Bennett, Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, has been supportive. Mm-hmm. Honorable Seamus O'Regan, Minister of Natural Resources, has been supportive. The federal government is interested, but what we need is an actual plan, and I think we need that plan now. This is the time to do it. And then finally, my final comment is, it's also a question of sovereignty.
Right.
You know, this is an important part of Canada. We haven't invested a lot, and part of sovereignty is making sure that you're actually contributing to the land that's part of your nation.
Right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Amar, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, and good luck in your studies.
Thank you so much. Thanks to Amar Al-Jundi for talking to me today. Next week, we're going to talk about national security in the Canadian North. Stay tuned.